All right, it's Fairfield County Live and Local. We're presented by the Sono Collection. My name is John Kamal from 95.9 The Fox. So my guest today is the founder of award-winning music and media company Launchpad Media. He's been a senior A&R executive at Capitol Records, Virgin, Elektra, 11/7, Billboard, and last but not least, he's part of the reason why you've heard of artists like Nelly Furtado, The Black Keys, and John Mayer. So I got Steve Trampish here. How you doing, man?
Good. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, dude. Thanks for hanging out. I mean, listen, you sound like a busy man, so I appreciate you making the time for this.
Thanks. I appreciate it. This is really cool.
Well, so I mean, and you know, I said this to you before we went live. Like, you have a pretty cool job. Can you describe what you do? Because I mean, I was a musician for a long time, but I never got far enough to have like an A&R rep. Yeah. So if you could share just for the listeners a little bit about what it is.
It's segued across my whole career. It wasn't always what I do today. Today I do A&R, but I'm also an artist manager and a consultant. Mm-hmm. Like that. But like when I first started, I mean, I started off on just like answering the telephone lines at a local radio station on Long Island where I grew up, just in high school, like just because I loved it and stuff like that.
Right.
WLIR, big influential, like, 80s station back in the day.
Yeah.
Then I did college radio. And then I did, I got an internship at a major record company in Manhattan and just was like, this is great. Like, how do I do this for the rest of my life? So, but even back then, I was just an assistant in a department that I didn't, necessarily think was my calling, but, just kind of working my way up the ladder and getting to know people and networking and everything like that. And then just sort of segued into, finally getting, the reputation for having good ears and for being able to find things like super early and having the instinct to really, develop their careers and make them into something, that everybody knows now. So.
Well, and that's kind of the cool part, right? Is people talk about being discovered. That's sort of your job. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. And that's obviously an oversimplification of it, but your job is to go out there and find and then serve as a liaison between, new artists and the label.
Yeah. And it's also to, when you're at a label, it's also to work with the existing, artists that are already, signed to the label and stuff like that.
Sure.
And work on their next records and developing their careers even more than they already have been. So, but yeah, I mean, people always ask me like, how do you find things? And it's just like, there's no one way. It's just, you never know where the next thing is going to come from. I mean, I have very particular, ways that I do things. I'm very methodical and I'm kind of one of the first people who started this thing called A&R Research, which is kind of like Moneyball for the music business.
And right.
I got a really good reputation with that and found a lot of, people who became really huge. And that's what really blew the doors open on my career, at least from the career perspective of, I'd worked at a major record company before, but like I said, I was an intern and then I was an assistant in the radio promotion department and video promotion and then in publicity. And then, the thing that really kind of just blew the doors open for me was just becoming like one of the first people to really, have a knack for using data back in, the late 90s when people, weren't even like thinking about these things and to really float things to the top.
Well, right. And I read that in your bio, how you kind of like, pushed this data driven. I like the Moneyball comparison. That's what was the difference between kind of the old way of doing it and the new way? Or was it really just like a Moneyball situation where like the old timers used their gut and like had some kind of new.
So the process. Old way of doing it, which, it's still prevalent and there's nothing, I don't knock it, but like, sure. So a lot of it was just, kind of like a funnel. Like, so. There's an ecosystem around the labels and the major companies and all the big companies that you want to, if you're an artist, you want to be with. So, yeah. and it's big lawyers, it's big managers, and it's just big people. And you can't, even these big lawyers and big managers have tons of clients and not all of them are signed. And it's just kind of working your way through the top, the big opening of that funnel and getting down closer and closer to where you can get a record deal. Okay. And it's just having those relationships. So a lot of times, the old thing was about who you know. Like it was about, so-and-so, a big lawyer or manager is shopping something right now. XXX labels are all after it. So we should be after it too. And we should take a meeting with them and we should sign this band. Or it was also about like kind of like copycat stuff. It's like, so who's, you know, I'm just going to throw something out there. Maroon 5, I don't know. So, you know, we need to find the next thing that sounds like Maroon 5, because Maroon 5 is hot right now. Not thinking by the time you actually sign them and record it, like down the line, Maroon 5 might not be so hot anymore. But anyway, so, but that's kind of like more of like the old, and, you know, obviously people followed more like trends and stuff like that. I mean, you know, if they started to see sold out shows and stuff like that, they might, you know, big ones, it might become a blip on their radar, but that was generally like, you know, in my opinion, like the way it was done. And it was even done like that, even when I was first getting, you know, all the, so between my first, you know, like I was saying, the assistant jobs when I was at EMI, SBK, Chrysalis, I went to do a startup company, which was, it was the first social network before, even before MySpace. So it was like four of us sitting in a little room right off of Central Park on Broadway. And we started this thing through Billboard magazine. But it was called Billboard Talent Net. And it was, it was basically what MySpace became. It was, you know, it had social profiles with pictures and streaming music.
Okay.
It was like real audio or whatever. And, but the thing that was really interesting about that, you know, I was kind of in charge of all the artists and the data and the industry work. And the thing that was really cool about that was, you know, for the first time, you know, obviously people could go and create their own profiles and put music out there on the internet under a name like Billboard too. But we had charts in the magazine that were based upon the data that we were pulling about popularity and stuff in the background. And that hadn't been done before.
Right.
So I had a column every 2 weeks in the magazine where I was kind of also highlighting things that I was hearing myself, but also, you know, finding from the data that was floating things up to the top. These weren't things that were being shopped by a big manager or lawyer or something like that. These were like John Mayer and Ludacris and, and, you know, all these other big names that, you know, I was finding that nobody was on. And so I would write these columns about it. And, you know, a lot of these things did get signed and started to blow up. And that's when, you know, a whole bunch of majors started saying, this guy, we got to hire this guy.
Yeah. Well, so, and this is, I mean, this is in what? This is like late 90s, early 2000s, right?
I left there at Billboard Talent Net about 2000 to take a job at Elektra.
Wow.
So this is like the late 90s. So, you know, this was pre-MySpace.
So how did, you know what? And that kind of, that also makes me think, I mean, you got a little bit, you had like a little bit of industry time before really file sharing exploded. How did file sharing kind of turn that whole system on its head? Cause I got to imagine that was huge.
And it all happened, you know, it all happened in, you know, that 5 years or so that I was at Elektra, it all happened. We had Metallica too. So, I mean, it all happened in that like 5 years. So it went from, you know, here we are, we're minting, you know, we're just minting CDs, we're just making money. And then, you know, and then things just, you know, and then the iPod came out, and then that was, you know, kind of controversial, but like, you know, and then all the piracy and stuff like that. And then within that 5 years, I mean, I saw a lot of my coworkers get let go. Elektra Records, where I was, you know, we had sister companies. We had Atlantic, it was WEA. So we had Warner, Elektra, and Atlantic. So, you know, and eventually towards the end of my time there was when, you know, Elektra was essentially being folded into Atlantic and ceased to be a label until just, you know, a few years ago, actually. They brought the name back. But, you know, at one point, employed hundreds and hundreds of people, whatever, you know, field staffs, you know, fully radio staffs all over the country and stuff like that. And then just because of piracy within a few years, just decimated.
My God.
Yeah.
I mean, now that's, and obviously you made it through that, but that's, I mean, that's that must've been crazy. And just the kind of dark, like, maybe this is the wrong word, but like almost like Darwinian nature of how, like, just, you know, like, like this was when things started to go viral, or at least when I noticed things going viral. Like you'd have a certain file or a certain song would kind of get shared around, and a band would blow up that way without any kind of major label support. Like, would you guys track stuff like that? Like who's big on BearShare or LimeWire or all those kind of places?
For me, coming from the background that I have and the reasons that I was hired to do what I was doing, because I was so good at it at Billboard, and like, and I was just, you know, so, and the thing about that, just tracking all those things, you know, and like even on those things like LimeWire and everything else that you said, like there's, there's still so much that you have to cut through and sort through. Even data is like, you know, it's just this whole another thing where, you know, it's a whole another massive undertaking, no matter how you're sifting and sorting through it. But eventually, like, you know, cause at Billboard I was just working with the data that we were pulling in, you know, from all the bands and artists that were signed up to our platform. But what I started to do once I got to Elektra was not only build upon that, but then go into everything from ticketing to, you know, anything like from to sales to, you know, and I just started putting together ways of tracking sales of any independent artist on a national and international basis. Same thing with, you know, concert tickets, same thing, you know, even local shows, even doing more like one-to-one things, just constantly, you know, building relationships with the local show people just to see what's the whole thing was to build like a system where you can find telltale signs of a genuine audience reaction at its most basic, you know, early level.
Okay.
And, you know, and then to see how things were progressing, you know, and then just to see how things built and find a natural reaction to it. Because at the end of the day is like, you know, you can throw something against the wall and start and market it all you want, but you're going to, you know, if you already know something beforehand is working because you've already sort of tested it. And this was sort of our test market to do it that way. So
what are some of those telltale signs that you were talking about? What are you looking for?
It could be anything like there. It could be, you know, like, again, like live concert attendance. I mean, like I could tell you, you know, one of my big bands, Red Jumpsuit Apparatus, like A&R managed, did a bunch of things with. So, I mean, the original thing on that one was, I mean, there's a different story for everything, but the original story on that one was, they were just a local band in Jacksonville, Florida. They were selling at a small little intimate, you know, music venue, probably the size of the Acoustic or so.
Yep.
And then called Jackrabbits. And then eventually, you know, and then the guy down there who I had relationships with all the venues too, all across the country. I was completely blanketing them all the time saying, hey, you know, if anyone ever starts to sell at your venue, you know, let me know about it. And then from there, you sort of have to also use your judgment and your instincts and use your ears to see if it's palatable to a national or a global audience. So,
okay.
But for them, an example, like they were selling out that, he sends it to me. I go, oh, this is really freaking good. And then like a week or two later, he's like, yeah, they sold that out. And now I just booked them into my whatever it was, 700 or 1,000 seater. He's like, and they just sold that out too. And I'm going, okay, that's a genuine, audience reaction. That's kids freaking out about something because it's so great. It's a lot less work to beat people over the head to like and appreciate and love something than to start from scratch and then just try and, you know, manufacture it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, God, that's so. I mean that really is so interesting. So there is, though. I mean, and you mentioned, you know, like deciding whether or not something's going to be palatable for a national audience as opposed to a local audience. That is just, I mean, because that's obviously a matter of taste, but that's just a gut instinct for you, or is there data behind that as well?
There is some data, but it is. So it's, I liken this because there are quite a few people now since I've sort of done this. There was one or two other people kind of, you know, doing this in the beginning too, but this, it's become quite a thing now in the business. And it's just, I just akin it to another, it's a way of floating things to the top, but then, you know, there's no machine learning or algorithm or anything else that could replicate, you know, just human instincts in music. Every once in a while there's a, you know, Wired magazine publishes something and saying, oh, you know, there's this new algorithm that's going to, you know, I'm like, yeah, right.
Right.
Or,
right.
I mean, I grew up, you know, I just grew up as a music freak. Just love music, played, you know, close to 10 things.
Oh, really?
Always played, come from a musical family. I mean, it's just in my blood. I mean, I absorbed every record that I could get growing up, liner notes, who worked on everything. It's just, you know, having that, you know, and then, you know, but there are certain ways of looking at data to see, you know, and then of course there's regional sounds, like especially in like urban music, hip hop, rap and stuff like that. There's regional sounds, you know, Southern and everything like that. But then, you know, so there have been plenty of times where it depends who you're working with. So if I'm working at a huge, you know, major label, I mean, we take all that into consideration. So there might be, you know, tons of things being floated to the top, so to speak, but then, you know, your natural instincts have to kick in and say, okay, that's never good. That's a regional thing. That's never going to work across the rest of the country. Like, right. That sound isn't going to be, something that, you know, is going to be worthy of the level of investment we're going to be, a company like us would put into to breaking something.
Is the goal always to go national with it, or rather, I guess, I mean, at when you were at Electra, I'm sure the goal was always, you know, to break into a national launch. But is there ever a conversation of like, well, listen, this may not work really well in the South, but it could make a lot of money in the Northeast. Let's give X amount of resources instead of Y amount of resources and get a return on that anyway.
I mean, Electra,
or is that an insane idea? That could be a completely crazy idea.
No. It's an interesting question, because Electra was a very unique situation. It was a very boutique type company. It always has been. And so we had people like Billy Bragg and Wilco doing records together. We had like Natalie Merchant. We had things that, you know, maybe, you know, that started off in like either Boston or wherever. And it was kind of like, you know, I'm not sure, but, you know, it was always a very calculated, decision-making process about return on investment, basically. I think, you know,
sure.
And about how to best utilize, the lanes that we have to drive releases through and stuff like that. So, I'd like to say that, you know, Electric did definitely take more chances on things that might have been more regional, but like, and try to break them nationally. But I think, you know, especially in this day and age, now that it has become more of a thing, you know, the data-driven approach, at least, like, people tend to try and hit home runs. They tend to try to go in there and hit home runs rather than, you know, just the small little, you know, singles and doubles and triples and stuff like that. So,
all right. So it is mostly swinging for the fences at this point.
It depends on the company, you know.
Okay.
So it just depends. But yeah, I mean, of course, everyone wants to get the maximum level of return on their investment they can. So, I mean, that tends to be the direction that things go in.
What's the biggest difference between what you would look for in an artist initially, like at the start of your career, let's say around like 2000, as opposed to now? I mean, obviously, there's a 20-year difference there, but there's also a world of technology that's come into it in between. Or is it kind of the same thing?
So your question is about the technology, or what's it? What's your?
My question is what's your metric for what's going to work and what isn't going to work? Has the way that you discover new artists changed within the last 20 years?
It's constantly changing. So just to give you an example, like the Billboard things back in the late 90s, that was just based upon one stream of data from a platform that we owned. We had exclusive access to that data, and we, you know, if we had been a label at that point, we would have been, you know, really doing well,
because we
had exclusive access to that data. And then later, like, some of the labels did actually try to do that, but then, you know, like I said, after I left there and I started to do that sort of thing at Elektra, and then subsequently at Virgin and Capital, whatever, I just started. It was always about what's available to me. Like, you know, when I first got to Elektra, I walked around to every department. I introduced myself. I said, "No, you're radio. What have you got? Oh, you got BDS. You got MediaBase. Oh, what kind of data do you get? Oh, how do I sift through that?" And then I would talk to the BDS and MediaBase people and say, "Oh, well, how do I get access to this?" They're like, "Well, we could actually build a special report for you that's just independent artists only and filter out all the major label stuff. So you can only find." I'm like, "Oh, okay." And I kept just figuring out. And the same thing with venues. I would find ways to filter out, you know, attendance and stuff like that. And I even started to talk to, like, you know, the merch companies and saying, "Hey, you know," and or like at the time it was like CD manufacturers and stuff like that. But I'm saying, like, you know, build those relationships. So, hey, you know, if somebody you've never heard of all of a sudden comes in, places an order for 10,000 CDs, I want to know who that person is.
Right.
You know, who are these people who are making a 10,000 CD order or whatever it is? And, you know. And then, you know, and that eventually, so you never knew where it was going to come from. And it was very hodgepodge and, you know, pulled together, but it was just like, you know, finding, you know, just, and as time has gone on, obviously there's just much different, it's just constantly changing. So tomorrow or next week or next month or next year, there's going to be a different, probably won't always be the same. It's, you know, YouTube is here right now, and there's lots of other things, and there's lots of ways to pull data and look at things, but, you know, it's going to constantly be changing. We don't know what the next thing is going to be. So it's just always wherever that information comes from. It's just, you know, whatever information I can get that tells me what real people, not like, you know, some manufacturer audience or things that are being, you know, and there were lots of, along the way, there was lots of, you know, ways of people gaming the system.
Data,
and there still is on Spotify and other places like that.
People buy likes constantly.
By streams and by whatever they do, and they get bots and they get all sorts of things. And that's always been a case in one form or another. And there's ways to, you know, as a person that does what I do, to suss that out and say, you know, I see what's happening there, but based upon, you know, how, what I've learned over, like, you know, whatever, it's not real.
Right.
It's fake.
It sounds like it's less about having like one set way of doing things and more about just constantly being on the lookout for the new way to gauge audience interest.
Yeah. It's a constantly evolving thing. It's just this constantly evolving process. It'll never stay the same because technology never stays the same, and data, you know, just there's, you know, as soon as, you know, I'm always, you know, hungry, looking for new ways and new forms of data for this, you know, for this business. So I can just, you know, jump in there and figure out ways to float things to the top, like I said.
Right. Well, not to be having you reveal all your tricks, but how do you suss out the fake like thing? Is it just a matter of like checking out like amount of views or subscribers and likes as opposed to views, or is it like?
I mean, it really just depends on what the platform is. It could be, you know, if so, like say independent artists are getting radio play, you know, and the idea is to say, you know, to give off the impression that, you know, hey, I'm an independent artist getting radio play, but then you can look at the day parts and see that they're only getting played overnight and see what the audience is, and then gauge that against, you know, how well something is actually streaming. You know, there's just different differentials between things that, you know, so something is very popular on one thing, but, you know, where it's actually serving the consumer, whatever, like say in a place like Spotify, and it's really, you know, not doing anything. Yeah, there's just different, you know, instinctual ways that you just kind of look at things. And it's also at a certain point, you put your ears on it too. You just say to yourself, you're like, yeah, it doesn't.
Is this really that good?
there's only been like one or two times I was wrong about something. I was like, yeah, that doesn't really pass the ears and the smell test and something like that. And I was like, okay, you know, that actually was real. It actually was reacting and stuff like that. But, you know, it's just that, you know, you have to also sort of like put your, you know, smell test thing. So.
One or two out of a 20-year career is not bad, man. Now you mentioned streams, and I don't know that this is necessarily the way it worked, but I did notice this question in the comments section. I want to get your idea on it. How can we get artists paid more fairly on streaming platforms? And then the Ryan who's asking the question says it seems weighted towards the heavy hitter who gets millions of plays and nothing for indie artists.
I mean, that's a good question. You know, that really comes down, I think. I think it has less that, you know, my suggestion would be to everyone pretty much. The majors have a stake in companies like Spotify. They have a stake in it.
Oh yeah.
By doing these deals that they've done, they've gotten a piece of the company. So, one way, I think, you know, one way or another, and they have such a massive bandwidth with all of the huge artists that they have, that they do have this sort of block power, and they are going to get paid better. They are going to get paid, you know, more, obviously, because they're getting a hell of a lot more streams than an independent artist. But I think, you know, as far as like independent artists, I think the suggestion, what I'm getting at is like, I think, you know, independent artists have to find much smarter ways to break through the crowding to get even noticed so they can get their streams up. I guess what I'm getting at is we should be less worried about it. Is there a difference between, you know, one artist is getting paid and another is getting paid or something like that. But I think it's just about building your audience and building your connection and building and just getting, I forget what the last number was, but there's like something like several hundred thousand songs or something like that being uploaded every day.
Right.
I mean, you have to find a way to cut through that. And so for any artist, that's really the hardest thing.
Well, what in your experience has been the balance there? Is it good? Is it good marketing or good music? Like will good music rather just always rise to the top no matter what? Or is, I mean, is good marketing a key component of
it? Yeah, you have to get the word out. You can't, you know, like I said, several hundred thousand songs, whatever it is, every day being uploaded to a place like Spotify. How do you, even if you could have, you know, Let It Be, and no one's, if no one, if it just falls into a you know, we're no one into an abyss with 200,000 songs, and the next day to 200,000 the next day, no one's ever going to hear it. You have to, you know, figure out the ways, you have to figure out the best ways to market yourself and get it in front of people, so it can eventually, you know, catch on its own life and become its own thing.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, you know, it's just, it's, you do have to put in that work.
So what, you know, to kind of, to kind of switch gears a little bit, what got you into business for yourself now? Cause now you've got Launchpad Media. Yeah. And like you said earlier, you've expanded beyond just, you know, just A&R. I mean, you're doing artist management. You know, there's a label component to Launchpad. What prompted that decision?
So there's only been two times, in my career since I graduated college that I haven't worked at a big, in-house at a big, you know, record label. One of them was between Elektra and Virgin. I've been talking to Jason Flom, who is the co-CEO of Atlantic Records and also the CEO of Lava Records, on the side of, you know, when I was working at Elektra, just as friendly and stuff like that. And because, you know, we got along really well, but then also as the writing started to become more apparent on the wall that Elektra might not even be there anymore, we started to talk about me going over there. And I sort of, I was kind of a little jaded on doing A&R again. It was like my dream job. I couldn't believe I was getting paid to do it and stuff like that. But I had added up all the things I kind of brought to the table through my systems of, and that weren't signed. And like within like 4 or 5 years, it ended up being like 40 or 50 million records.
Oh, wow.
Which probably would have saved Elektra and made Atlantic fold into us.
Yeah.
And I'm going to myself and going like, I can't do this anymore. It was not even, you know, just, it was just the emotional side of it. I was like, is it me? Like, what is this? Like, what, you know? And so I took a leap of faith instead of kind of going over and continuing that conversation with Jason to go over to Atlantic. I sort of just took a leap of faith myself. I'm just going to go out and do the same thing I did, you know, and just do it for myself. And that's when I started Launchpad. That was like, I don't know, like 14 years ago.
Wow, man.
And I didn't even have an idea of what it was going to be. I was like, I don't know what's going to be. I'm just going to find artists like an A&R guy and try and get them deals. I don't know if I'll be their manager, their whatever. I don't know. I never managed really anyone before.
Sure.
So I'll just do that. So, and then I just kind of came up with the name because I had a rocket on the wall for something. I'm like, Launchpad or something. And yeah. And then the first one that I found in those first few months was Red Jumpsuit. And, you know, within 6, 7, 8 months, got, you know, developed them, got a bidding war. And, you know, right before, we literally had the long form of the record deal from Capitol Records sitting in our office, ready to sign the execution copies. And, over the weekend and like on Sunday night, I get a phone call from Jason Flom. I'm going, Jason Flom, you know, one of the biggest record guys outside of Clive David.
Sure.
Says to me, hey, Tramposh, what are you doing tomorrow? I'm going, I don't know. I think I'm signing a record deal with my band. He's like, no, you're not. You're coming to work with me at Virgin Records. I'm starting tomorrow. You're my first hire. And I lived like a couple blocks from the offices. I'm like, this is pretty cool. Yeah, I'll do this.
Okay.
I could be a manager for this band that's getting, that just is about to do this deal with Capitol.
Yeah.
And I'll be the A&R guy at Virgin. And I'm like, this is great. And then the first day that we're there, he's like, Tramposh, you know, he's looking at the roster and he's like, it was crap, man. Virgin for a long time, no one wanted to go to Virgin. He's like, we need stuff really fast. You know, what have you got? I'm like, wow. I mean, we got this band and we had a bidding war and Capitol won the bidding war and, you know, and, but you know, I could talk to them, you know, maybe they'll fly up here tonight or something like that. And he's like, yeah, I love it. I want to sign these guys. And literally we flew them up. But anyway, long story short, your question was about, I'm going in.
No, I was enjoying that story. You don't have to cut yourself short.
No, well, let me finish.
Yeah, no, please do.
The crazy part was, we talk about sister companies. Capitol Records was Virgin Records' sister company. It's much more successful brother-sister company.
Sure.
and here we are, like our first days in the job, Jason Flom and I, and we just basically stole the band off the table from Capitol and signed it to Virgin. We basically just crossed out the name in the top and put, you know, Virgin.
Sure, yeah.
And so I ended up being the A&R guy, the manager, and a whole bunch of other hats all in the same building. And that was great. We had a gold record in 3 months and a platinum one in, you know, I don't know, a year or so. And but anyway, so that was one of the times in my career where that's when I started Launchpad. It was also one of the one times in my career where I didn't work at a company. And then the second time is now. And yeah. it's sort of morphed over the years just to be whatever I was, because I was working at labels a lot of that time in between. So I didn't necessarily have all the time in the world to devote to building the company, but it was what it was. And honestly, you know, after I left New York City and moved up in this direction, I don't know, 9 years, 10 years ago,
yeah,
I started to really become more focused on it because I was like, I don't really feel like getting on a train every day.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was like, yeah, let me put some more time into this. And then that's when even though I did work for another label in between that, you know, that's when I started to pay a lot more attention to building kind of what it's morphed into today, which is like it's management. Like you said, it's a label. I've actually just brought in Red Jumpsuit and their entire catalog.
Nice.
You know, which is really exciting working with them again, and you know, a bunch of other stuff. So you know, and there's also a consulting component to it too, like working with people who catch 22s. You know, I always found people find, especially starting off independent artists, is that, you know, how do you get those big people to work with you? How do you get the big manager, the big agent, or the big attorney, or something like that? And a lot of these people are mainly percentage based. So, you know, they're not going to take on a client that isn't making any money because they have lots of other clients that are making money. So I developed sort of more of a consulting aspect of the company as well to be able to, you know, when I found something that I really liked, to work with them in a way that, you know, if they had some sort of financial backing and stuff like that to work with me on like more of a consulting aspect until they finally got over the hump to, you know, make themselves, relying upon a traditional commission. So,
sure.
Yeah.
What was the turnaround time for like Red Jumpsuit, for example, from the time when you just like first heard them like, oh, okay, yeah, these guys can work to then creating this bidding war and then, you know, signing papers?
It wasn't very long. Like, so I heard the music and I knew it immediately. And there was one song, Face Down, which is now like an evergreen. It's considered an evergreen in this business. An evergreen is a song that's just going to, you know, for the rest of time, it's just going to be, you know, a huge song and everyone will remember it and it'll always make money. And I heard that, the demo that they had their MySpace profile. And I heard that, it was like 3 or 4 on that thing. And even after this information, I liked all the other songs. And I heard, you know, I was hearing about these crowds and everything like that. I'd never been to Jacksonville. And as soon as I heard Face Down, I started just like going crazy. I'm like, I have to work with these guys. I have to. I'm like, I'm just going nuts. I'm like, I got to work with these guys. And I flew down to Jacksonville and we signed a manager deal. And then we just, probably only, you know, a few months after that, just really pulling together the music and just coming up with the marketing approach to the labels. And then just one day just blasting it out to everybody. And then, you know, phone wouldn't stop ringing.
Now, is that an approach? What I wonder is that an approach that continues to work now? I mean, you know, with streaming being, you know, the way things go, and of course, you know, like live building up a big community around the live performance, is that still the way that, like, is that still the pathway to success, or does it work a little bit different 14, 15 years later?
I mean, I think there really isn't like one way to success. It depends what kind of artists you are, first of all. Like you know, a lot of, you know, more of the urban and the pop acts generally don't play out or tour a whole lot, and that's not really so much of a traditional, you know, at least at that level, metric you can really rely upon. So it's just you know, I think it's different by genre. I think it's just different by lots of things, and it just comes down to, you know, at least with them, I had that metric. You know, and a lot of it all is also, you know, even as an A&R person, even when you're working in an office as an A&R person, a lot of it is being able to very succinctly, you know, describe, you know, it's almost like an elevator pitch, being able to describe exactly, you know, Sylvia Rohn, who I worked with at Elektra, who's, you know, has also been the CEO of Motown. She's CEO of Epic now. She's, you know, she taught me a really great thing. Like I would come in there with these great, you know, things that are just breaking out in some, you know, territory, something like that. And she loved the music, but then she turned to me and she goes, but what's the story? And meaning like, you know, like, what's the story? What's, because there's always, you know, that's great that there's these metrics and like that, and there's these, there's this reaction, but what is the story? What is going to, you know, what is press going to react to? Like, what are people, genuine people, they're, you know, and the thing is, there's always a story. You just have to find it. It's marketing. Sure. Yeah. You just have to find the story. And it's just, you know, really honing and developing sort of like, you know, for me to get things, you know, even with say jumpsuit, like I just really honed and developed, the whole angle to approaching people with it, saying, you know, obviously the music is great, but look how it's reacting. It's doing this, it's doing this, it's doing this, it's doing this. It's genuine, you know? And yeah. And it did what it was supposed to. It did, you know, it reacted on a national and global level the same way it was reacting at that time in Jacksonville.
Right on. Saw this question here. I've kind of been sitting on it for a little while, but I feel like this is a good time to bring it up. What is your best memory of an artist that you didn't think would make it, but then completely surprised you when they did?
Oh, wow. Wow.
And thank you to Bob for asking this question, by the way.
Yeah, I know, Bob. Oh, Bob. All right. you know, like, I'm going to admit this. This is one of the first times I've ever said this. Like, I've had one or two, like I said earlier, that I sort of think it's like, you know, it's, there's something to it. But only for a short time until it just really started to blow up to the point. I was on Jack Johnson super early.
Okay.
And okay. I loved it. I mean, I grew up surfing on Long Island. I was like, oh, that's great. You know, but I sort of like, I think even being a surfer lifeguard dude from Long Island, like I was, I think I almost was jaded by that. I was kind of like, I think like I just overthunk it. Like I was just overthinking it too much. I was saying, you know, maybe it's just all the surfing community that are just embracing this guy. And maybe the music isn't really the driving factor in that.
Oh, so you were assuming it was like your own personal bias that was making you like the music. Okay. I mean, that makes sense though.
And to this day, so it didn't last forever, but at the point where I finally started to get over that, like I was still one of the first people in there, but he had already started to talk to like Universal and stuff like that. And it was kind of a little bit, you know, they were a much bigger fish in the sea than we were. Than Elektra was. We lost out on that one. That was one that, you know, I'm a big fan. And like, I remember just talking to them and, you know, even throughout the whole process and being like, I'll go surfing with you. Come on. You know, it's like, it just wasn't work. Like, the guys at Universal don't know how to surf. Come on.
These guys are squares, man. You got to come with me.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. See, there you go. Trust your gut. If you're listening right now, trust your gut.
Don't overthink it. Don't overthink things.
Sure. So I just had a thought and it's now just completely, you know what I did? I overthought it. It's just completely ran away from me. But of course, how could I forget this? So what, and I mean, you know, this is the depressing but necessary part of this interview process these days is what's the COVID reaction for doing what you do? I mean, you know, touring's out. Live shows are out, but live streams are huge and streaming is, you know, obviously got to be bigger than ever. I mean, how has this changed the way you do your business?
I mean, it's from the management side of things right now. It's obviously changed for, well, not just me, for every manager and certainly booking agents, because there's no, you know, major form of revenue for these artists or they're touring. So, you know, bands that, you know, I could tell you friends of mine who manage, you know, number of successful bands, and they tell me, yeah, like my bands are all looking for, you know, side gigs right now because they are used to going out, especially in the summertime, and earning, you know, basically their year money, and then, you know, going home and being able to live off that for the rest of the year. And you know, they don't have that anymore. So and that whole ecosystem is affect, you know, it's obviously a trickle down to everyone else in that ecosystem. Agents, you know, are being hit hard by that. You know, I have an artist now. You know, and it's also the record labels, like, you know, so traditionally, especially a touring type of artist, again, like, you know, but they're traditionally, you know, record releases have multifaceted marketing plans planned around it. And one of the main components of that is obviously being out on the road and not only touring and playing in front of people and getting, you know, music out there, but also making appearances at radio stations at all sorts of things. You can't do any of that now. So how do you, and the question has been also just obviously for record companies is how to, you know, how to just pivot and think differently and, you know, come up with release plans that, you know, aren't, specifically based on old ways of doing things. So, and that's also, you know, it's, you know, so when we were first going through this all many, you know, feels like many, many months ago, not to say, but, you know, however long it's been, like people were like, we're going to push it out to, you know,
it's been 100 years, dude. It's been 100 years.
You know, it's crazy. One of my clients is, probably is one of the biggest things of this, whole COVID.
Yeah.
The Tiger King, I was involved in the music on that.
Oh, were you really?
Yeah. I mean,
oh, that's very cool.
But like, who would have thought that the Tiger King, as the thing is dragged on, who would have thought that this was the most like normal thing out of everything that happened this whole time? So,
oh my God. If you're listening to this on the podcast, go watch it on YouTube so you can see what I just saw. It's amazing.
That's a whole nother being involved in that whole thing as it was happening is just a whole. That's a whole nother. That was hilarious. Actually, it was really fun. But it's affected so many different people in so many different ways, and you know, it's just kind of, you know, rewriting the. Yeah, you know, so what do? You give up? No, you find different ways of marketing something. You pivot and you put more resources towards live streams, like you said.
Yeah.
I mean, I was involved in a major consulting study, ended about a month ago, ended up being like a 150-page report with Live Nation in the middle of it. And, you know, we just did so many different studies on different things about, you know, how ways, and some of them are starting to be rolled out, like these drive-through, I think that's really interesting, the drive-through concerts and stuff like that. They're doing the ones with the tailgate areas and stuff like that.
I heard a rumor from our mutual friend Drew Angus that you were getting involved in something like that over in Easton.
Yeah, it's something that we're bouncing around. It was at first supposed to be, you know, obviously a normal one, normal,
right.
Normal music experience, but it's something, you know, we're talking about.
Oh, so this was something that you started pre-corona as like, hey, let's do a show at this drive-in, that'll be fun. And now did I misunderstand that?
Yeah, I can't go into too many details, but basically it was going to be, if you're familiar with the Greenwich Town Fair, not the Greenwich, is it called the Town Fair? The big concert they put on in Greenwich.
Yeah, they had like Skinner last year. Yeah, I know you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was kind of like that, but more of an Easton vibe.
Okay.
And it was just something, you know, but it was just obviously can't really be done. But, you know, and I don't know, who knows? But we'll see. I mean, we don't know how long this is going to last. You know, like I said, I know lots of people, and I have lots of clients that, you know, started off by just pushing things back a few months, and then, you know, now it's been pushed back into next year. And even like the stuff that's been pushed back to next year, people are just kind of like, well, I don't know about that. But, you know, it's interesting, like, even with the way, you know, we're talking about just domestic stuff, but even like international stuff. So like Europe is actually, it feels like they're opening up, you know, and like Australia and New Zealand are just, they're getting ready to do festivals this summer. Like, you know, they're different territories are in different situations than we are. Where did we just happen to be? I mean, don't get me involved in talking.
No, I know. We're simpatico on that. I've gone over your social media, but we're not, but we don't have to get into it here. We don't have to get into it here.
It's affecting business right now. So.
Yeah. I can only imagine, New Zealand got rid of this thing inside of like a month.
Yeah, my understanding is they closed off everything, and they're an island, right? So they just no one's coming in or out.
Yeah.
So you know, in Australia, you know, is doing better, and like in Europe is doing better. So like I have clients now who are booking, you know, festival their festival dates were for this summer. They've been bumped to next year, and they're actually starting to route other tours and other dates. And that's, you know, it doesn't feel like, you know, feels like there's a glimmer of hope in those. So. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I mean, we're all stuck in this together, right?
Oh God. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. But no, I mean, and you're right. We are. It's an evolution. Hopefully not a de-evolution.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, let's try to end this with something a little bit peppier. This is kind of an inverse of Bob's question before. Gene's asking, was there an artist that everyone else thought? Gene, by the way, that's a good friend of mine. He's living in Australia right now.
Oh, cool.
That's a good tie into this. Was there an artist that everyone else thought was a flop, but that you believed would be big?
So many, and
the artist ended up being successful. Sorry, what was that?
No, so many. So that's
so many. Aha. Uh-huh.
that goes into the story of like what I, of how I started Launchpad when I was in that section between staying at Elect or and going in, maybe going into Atlantic or just starting my own company and taking a leap of faith in myself, because I'd had so many that I brought, you know, through my ways of doing things. People weren't really ready for what I was doing. They weren't really understanding of it. They weren't like, you know, when I brought in my first week after I'd written a column about him and Billboard through the site, and my first week at Elektra, I bring in John Mayer, like, and I'm going, we should sign this guy right away.
And I like that you kind of just put that one, you know, you had a first week of Elektra, bring in John Mayer. That's huge though. That's, I mean, yeah, that's like,
he was just a guy in Atlanta. I was calling him on a cell phone and I was just like, hey dude,
wow,
really believe in you. And you know, the reaction, I'm not gonna, you know, people were just like, oh, what is this? Like, who's the lawyer? Who's the manager? Who, you know, all these things. I'm going, you don't get it. And just bang. Right. You know, after a few years of that, I'm banging my head against, you know, and that's when I, you know, but there was lots. There were so many, like, you know, you could probably guess how many, like I said, 40, 50 million records worth of it. So.
I mean, and I've looked at your website, and if you're interested, by the way, if you're watching this on YouTube or right now on the live stream, go check out launchpad.bz, the list of artists that you've either directly or just been on the team of bringing to our attention it's really incredible. You know, John Mayer, mentioned the Black Keys before, and it cross genre, whether it's pop, hip hop, you mentioned Ludacris.
Yeah,
I mean, it's really it's an incredible thing. You should write a book, man. Seriously.
Yeah, I'd love to. I love writing. Yeah, I mean, country, everything. I mean, a lot. You know, so a lot of those things on my site, they're not necessarily things that, you know, I obviously got to work with and sign. They're just things that I'm just basically making a portfolio of and saying I was there first.
You know? right.
You know, but yeah, I mean, across genres, and you know, I've always been a music lover. I grew up in a, you know, little in a neighborhood like. That was very, all my friends were, everyone was just into different things. And we just always had an open mind to music. So, I mean, even to this day, I mean, I'm working with country music even now next to a band that just won basically the Canadian equivalent of the Grammy Award last week, which is for hard rock and metal next to pop writer next to, you know, some other things that I haven't even added. I can't talk about or announce yet, but they're pretty awesome and big. They're going to be big. Or they actually are big already, and I'm going to be working with. So, so I'm just across the board with genres. I've always been, and the cool thing about that is, especially being a, you know, the data nerd that I am, I could, you know, you could find things the same way. But eventually, you do have to have the instinct and the ears to differentiate and float things to the top and figure out, you know, why something is reacting the way it is. Is it a regional thing? Is it a novelty? What is it? You know, it's like detective work.
I mean, dude, it's fascinating to hear you talk about it. I do. I got to tell you, I'm seeing so much pop up right here. But you know, I guess to kind of wrap this up, what do you have coming up, if anything, with everything going on? You know,
I got a management client, All Good Things. They're signed to Better Noise Records. They're the first band that I've signed there since another one called. Nothing More, which is really huge. Sure. They have 4 Grammy nominations a year or two ago. And we have a new single coming out. Their current song, which was basically mostly independent, just crossed the 25 million stream mark independently. So for that question, for that person who asked, you know, how you can do this independently, it could be done. We just crossed 25 million independently.
Sure.
And we have a record label now, and where they're going to be putting out, we've been working on this record for like a year or so now and making videos and doing lots of stuff in LA, and we're about to launch that. So it's All Good Things, and they're about to come out, and we actually have a big announcement on Thursday, which is pretty cool. We're doing some big things with that. And then obviously the Red Jumpsuit thing is really cool, getting that whole catalog and working with them again.
Yeah.
Tiger King, that's just something that, you know, who knows if that'll ever go away. There's Nicolas Cage is doing a movie. There's supposed to be a bunch of other, or TV show, a bunch of other stuff happening with that. So,
it's the greatest car accident that you've ever seen in your entire life.
I keep, you know, who knows with the pardon and stuff like that. Could be interesting.
Is there supposed to be a pardon? That's a whole other podcast episode.
I don't. People involved making that pardon, I don't have any wish to be involved with. So.
No.
But then, you know, then I've got a couple other things. I've got, like I said, a country artist who's, he's, he, you know, super up and coming, but he's the first. There's a huge like clothing company called Salt Life. It's a, you know, East Coast thing mostly, but it's like an ocean thing. And Jake Owen is the last country artist that they worked with, and he's the first one since Jake Owen. Jake Owen's enormous. So yeah. We did a live stream the first night that we announced that partnership. We had 30,000 people show up to his live stream. He had never done a live stream before.
Wow.
So that's a really big one. His name is Annie Purcell. And obviously I told you about Stryker, who just won the Canadian Grammy. It's called.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. We're working on a new record with them. They won the Juno Award. That's what it's called in Canada. And they're out of Edmonton, and we're working on some new stuff and hoping to get some new music out with them next year. Yeah, it's just always, you know, you never know what the next day is going to bring and what exciting thing is going to come along. And then, you know, and obviously, you know, you do your best for all your clients as well that you're working with.
Absolutely. All right. Let me leave you with one last thing. And it's an eye roll question for someone who does what you do. But, you know, I've got a lot of unsigned, hungry musicians who listen to and watch this and have been guests for me. What should a musician do right? What should an aspiring musician do right now to get themselves out there, to market themselves better, and to start making a living?
I mean, it all starts with the music. Music has to be the most important. Music is always the most important thing. You know, that's what I always tell people. Music is the most important thing. It's your product. If that's not right, I mean, all the marketing in the world isn't going to do it. So the music has to be right. So whatever that means, you know, to whatever each individual, whether that, and, you know, a lot of times, you know, there's people that can really help you fine tune your craft. Like that's kind of what I do on the consulting level. I work with lots of people to just kind of get their, you know, do artist development and things like that, just to get them to that next level. So, but it's just, you know, music is the most important aspect of it. It's why we're all here. It's what, you know, it's what people react to. It's what people feel deep into in their bodies and their souls. And it's just work on that. That's the most important thing. You know, the marketing thing is just, like we said earlier, it's just this constantly changing thing. It's just always going to be that way. And it's that's just like, you could spend a lot of time just trying to learn, you know, how to even how to do Facebook ads and Google ads and just try to even market yourself that way and Spotify. And, you know, it's all, but, you know, generally like, Spotify is the big place that everybody sort of wants to get the most traction at now. So,
of course.
My recommendation for that is to do it in an organic way. It, don't focus on the big numbers. Don't focus on trying to be, you know. And I have clients sometimes, people that come to me and ask me to get them on the radio. They're like, we have, you know, $50,000, get me on the radio. I'm like, I can get you on the radio and you'll get a big chart position, but I would probably, you know, want to maybe take money away from that and do things differently and stuff like that. But, you know, there's ways to work with Spotify and to really grow your audience in an organic way instead of just kind of hiring a company or something like that, just to give off the appearance that it's actually happening, right? You know, that you're getting all these likes or streams and follows and stuff like that. Try to do it in an organic way.
And it all starts with the music. That's great, man. That's the best possible answer to that, what I recognize is a very corny question, but, I appreciate it. Steve, thank you so much for hanging out with me today, man. If you want to check out the podcast of this, it's going to be posted up. What's today? It's July 7th. So this should be up on July 8th. Check it out. Fairfield County Live and Local podcast. That's on iTunes. It's on Spotify. Speaking of Spotify, Audio Boom and all those places. And make sure you check out Launchpad Media. If you are interested in any of the things that Steve was talking about today. And yeah, Steve, once again, thank you so much, man.
Welcome. Thanks.
All right. It's Fairfield County Live and Local. We're presented by the Sono Collection. Steve, stick around for me after I pull us off live. But thank you to everybody for watching. Thank you to everyone who commented. I'll see you on Sunday with Otta Pasternak. All right.